This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, Fantastic Voyage by Isaac Asimov, based on a screenplay by Harry Kleiner from the original story by Otto Clement and J. Lewis Bixby. Copyright 1966 by Bantam Books, Incorporated. All rights reserved. This book is based on a screenplay by Harry Kleiner. Copyright 1966 by 20th Century Fox Film Corporation. A condensed version of Fantastic Voyage has appeared in the Saturday Evening Post. Copyright 1966 by 20th Century Fox Film Corporation. Narrated by Roy Avers. This book contains 239 pages on 5 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the table of contents, or at the second beep to locate the beginning of the book. Annotation. This science fiction story of inner space is based on the popular motion picture, which tells of an experiment in miniaturization to clear a blood clot from the brain of an indispensable scientist. Prequel to Fantastic Voyage 2, RC 27172, 1966. From the book jacket. In Fantastic Voyage, Isaac Asimov, master craftsman of American science fiction, has written a fast-paced, imaginative thriller based on the original story by Otto Clement and J. Lewis Bixby, and on a screenplay by Harry Kleiner. It is an adventure story that combines science and suspense in ideal proportions and leaves the reader with an unforgettable experience. The time is the future, the setting the jungle land of a man's body with all its lurking terrors and unknown perils, its wonder and strange beauty. Jan Benesch, a brilliant refugee scientist who is the victim of an attempted assassination, lies in a coma with a potentially fatal blood clot in his brain. Locked in his mind is a secret of vital importance to the survival of the free world. The urgency of saving him is overwhelming, yet conventional surgery would inevitably destroy his mental powers, if not precipitate his death. The new secret process of miniaturization, whereby a whole army could conceivably be placed in a matchbox and sent anywhere in the world, offers a chance of saving Dr. Benesch. In spite of the enormous hazards involved, the scientists in charge of the process decide to miniaturize a team of doctors and technicians with all their equipment, including a small submarine, and inject them into Benesch's circulatory system to attack and destroy the blood clot from the inside. They have only 1 hour to complete their mission, for then the compressed matter of the submarine will expand and kill Dr. Benesch. Their task is a formidable one indeed, since they must find their way through torrential rivers in a weird wonderland teeming with unknown perils and monsters of every shape and color. Brownian motion buffets the tiny ship to and fro, while white blood cells threaten to absorb it. Included in the crew of 5 are the ship's 2 pilots, Dr. Duval, a famous neurosurgeon, and his beautiful assistant, Cora Peterson, a girl aloof and seemingly insensitive to the admiring attention of men, but very efficient and fiercely loyal to the great surgeon for whom she works. The leader of the strange expedition is Charles Grant, the most highly trusted and resourceful agent military intelligence could provide. His assignment is to observe every move of the carefully screened crew. This he does, only to discover it is more and more probable that one of the team is an enemy agent. Adventure, biochemistry, and nascent romance all build to a climax as, with only moments to spare, the voyagers mount their final assault on the blood clot. About the authors. Isaac Asimov is an associate professor of biochemistry at Boston University, whose credentials in the world of science are as impressive as his accomplishments in the world of fiction. He has written more than 60 books, including The Intelligent Man's Guide to Science, The Human Body and the Human Brain, and Pebble in the Sky, Caves of Steel, and I, Robot. Otto Clement, former publisher and film producer and for many years a well-known international literary agent, has written a number of stories of fantasy and suspense under several aliases. He conceived and wrote the original story of Fantastic Voyage with J. Lewis Bixby, a noted writer of science fiction, better known to the reading public as Jerome Bixby. Other books by Isaac Asimov. The Stars Like Dust. Foundation. Foundation and Empire. The Currents of Space. Second Foundation, The Martian Way and Other Stories, The End of Eternity, The Naked Sun, Earth is Room Enough, The Death Dealers, Nine Tomorrows, Triangle, The Hugo Winners, Editor, The Foundation Trilogy, 50 Short Science Fiction Tales, Co-Editor, The Rest of the Robots. Dedication to Mark and Marcia, who twisted my arm. Preface. This story, which has grown into both a book and a film, has several authors, all of whom have contributed to its present form in many different ways. For all of us, it was a long and arduous task and a great challenge, but also one of deep satisfaction and, I may say, of great delight. When J.L. Bixby and I wrote our original story, little did we know where it would lead or what would become of it in the hands of men of great imagination and superb artistry. Saul David, the film's producer, Richard Fleischer, the director and inspired conjurer of fancy, Harry Kleiner, who wrote the screenplay, Dale Hennessy, the art director and an artist in his own right, and the doctors and scientists who gave us so much of their time and their thinking. And finally, Isaac Asimov, who lent his pen and great talent to give form and reality to this phantasmagoria of facts and fancy. Otto Clement. Table of Contents. Chapter 1, Plane, Side 1. Chapter 2, Car, Side 1. Chapter 3, Headquarters, Side 1. Chapter 4, Briefing, Side 1. Chapter 5, Submarine, Side 2. Chapter 6, Miniaturization, Side 2. Chapter 7, Submergence, Side 2. Chapter 8, Entry, Side 2. Chapter 9, Artery, Side 3. Chapter 10, Heart, Side 3. Chapter 11, Capillary, Side 3. Chapter 12, Lung, Side 3. Chapter 13, Pleura, Side 4. Chapter 14, Lymphatic, Side 4. Chapter 15, Ear, Side 4. Chapter 16, Brain, Side 4. Chapter 17, Clot, Side 5. Chapter 18, Eye, Side 5. Chapter 1, Plane. It was an old plane, a four-engine plasma jet that had been retired from active service, and it came in along a route that was neither economical nor particularly safe. It nosed through the cloud banks on a trip that took it 12 hours, where 5 might have sufficed with a rocket-powered supersonic. And there was well over an hour to go. The agent aboard knew that his part of the job wouldn't be finished till the plane touched down and that the last hour would be the longest. He glanced at the only other man in the large passenger cabin, napping for the moment with his chin buried in his chest. The passenger didn't look particularly striking or impressive, but at the moment he was the most important man in the world. General Alan Carter looked up glumly when the colonel walked in. Carter's eyes were pouchy and the corners of his mouth sagged. He tried to bend the paperclip he was manhandling back into shape, and it flicked out of his hand.
"Nearly got me that time," said Colonel Donald Reed calmly.
His sandy hair lay back smoothly, but his short, graying mustache bristled. He wore his uniform with the same indefinable unnaturalness that the other did. Both were specialists, drafted for work in a super specialty, with military rank for convenience and, considering the applications of the field, somewhat out of necessity. Both had the CMDF insignia. Each letter was in a small hexagon, 2 above, 3 below. The middle hexagon of the 3 bore a symbol that further classified the man. In the case of Reed, it was a caduceus, marking him as a medical man.
"Guess what I'm doing," said the general.
"Flipping paperclips."
"Sure, and counting the hours, too." "Like a fool,"
his voice rose a controlled notch.
"I sit here with my hands wet, my hair sticky, my heart pounding, and I count the hours. Only now it's the minutes. 72 minutes, Don. 72 minutes, and they're down at the airport."
"All right. Why be nervous, then?"
"Is there anything wrong?"
"No, nothing. He was picked up safely. He was taken right out of their hands with, as far as we know, not a hitch. He got safely into the plane, an old one.
Yes, I know.
Carter shook his head. He wasn't interested in telling the other something new. He was interested in talking.
We figured that they would figure that we would figure time was of the utmost importance, so that we would pile him into an X-52 and rocket him through inner space. Only we figured they would figure that and have the anti-missile network at saturation level.
Reed said, paranoia. We call it in my profession. I mean, for anyone to believe they'd do that, they'd risk war and annihilation.
They might risk just that to stop what's happening. I'd almost feel we ought to risk it if the situation were reversed. So we took a commercial plane, a 4-engine plasma jet. I was wondering if it could take off, it was so old.
Did it?
Did it what?
For a moment, the general had sunk into blackened thought. Take off?
Oh, yes, yes, it's coming along fine. I get my reports from Grant.
Who's he?
The agent in charge. I know him. With him in charge, I feel as safe as it is possible to feel, which isn't much. Grant ran the whole thing, flicked Benish out of their hands like a seed out of a watermelon.
Well, then?
But I still worry. I tell you, Reed, there's only one safe way of handling matters in this damned racket. You've got to believe they're as smart as we are, that for every trick we've got, they've got a counter-trick. That for every man we've got planted on their side, they've got one planted on ours. This has been going on for over half a century now. We've got to be evenly matched, or it would have been all over long ago.
Take it easy, Al.
How can I? This thing now, this thing Benish is bringing with him, this new knowledge, may end the stalemate once and for all, and with ourselves as winners.
Reed said, I hope the others don't think so, too.
If they do, you know, Al, so far there have been rules to this game. One side doesn't do anything to back the other side into a corner so tight he has to use his missile buttons.
You've got to leave him a safe ledge to step back on.
Push hard, but not too hard.
When Benish gets here, they may get the notion they're being pushed too hard.
We have no choice but to risk that.
Then, as the afterthought plagued him,
if he gets here.
He will, won't he?
Carter had risen to his feet, as though to begin a hasty walk back and forth to nowhere. He stared at the other, then sat down abruptly.
All right. Why get excited? You've got that tranquilizer gleam in your eye, Doctor. I don't need any happy pills.
But suppose he does get here in 66 minutes. Suppose he lands at the airport. He's still got to be brought here, to be kept here safely.
There's many a slip twixt the cup and the lip, sing-song Reed. For God's sake, General, shall we be sensible and talk about consequences?
I mean, what happens after he gets here?
Come on, Don, let's wait for that till he does get here.
Come on, Al, mimicked the Colonel, an edge appearing on his own words. It won't do to wait till he gets here. It will be too late when he gets here. You'll be too busy then, and all the little ants at the Pentagon will start rushing about madly so that nothing will get done where I think it needs to be done.
I promise.
The general's gesture was a vague one of dismissal. Reed ignored it.
No, you're going to be unable to keep any promise you make for the future. Call the chief now, will you? Now. You can get through to him. Right now, you're the only one who can get through to him. Get him to understand that CMDF isn't the handmaiden of defense only. Or if you can't, get in touch with Commissioner Fernald. He's on our side. Tell him I want some crumbs for the biosciences. Point out there are votes on this. Look, Al, we've got to have a voice loud enough to be heard. We've got to have some fighting chance. Once Benish gets here and is jumped by all the real generals, damn them, we'll be out of commission forever.
I can't, Don, and I won't. If you want it straight, I'm not doing a damned thing till I've got Benish here. And I don't take it kindly you're trying to put the arm on me at this time.
Reed's lips went white. What am I supposed to do, General?
Wait, as I am waiting. Count the minutes.
Reed turned to go. His anger remained under tight control.
I'd reconsider the tranquilizer if I were you, General.
Carter watched him go without comment. He looked at his watch.
61 minutes, he muttered, and groped for a paperclip.
It was almost with relief that Reed stepped into the office of Dr. Michaels, the civilian head of the medical division. The expression on Michaels' broad face might never move higher than a quiet cheerfulness accompanied by, at most, a dry chuckle. But, on the other hand, it never dropped lower than a twinkling solemnity that never took itself, it would seem, too seriously. He had the inevitable chart in his hand, or one of them. To Colonel Reed, all those charts were alike, all a hopeless maze, and taken together, they were hopelessness many times compounded. Occasionally, Michaels would try to explain the charts to him, or to almost anyone. Michaels was pathetically eager to explain it all. The bloodstream, it seemed, was tagged with a trace of mild radioactivity, and the organism, it could be a man or a mouse, then took its own photograph, so to speak, on a laserized principle that produced a three-dimensional image. Well, never mind that, Michaels would say at that point. You get a picture of the entire circulatory system in three dimensions, which can then be recorded two-dimensionally in as large a number of sections and projections as would be required for the job. You could get down to the smallest capillaries, if the picture were properly enlarged. And that leaves me just a geographer, Michaels would add, a geographer of the human body, plotting its rivers and bays, its inlets and streams, much more complicated than anything on Earth, I assure you. Reed looked at the chart over Michaels' shoulder and said, "Whose is that, Max?" "No one's to speak of." Michaels tossed it aside. "I'm waiting, that's all. When someone else waits, he reads a book. I read a blood system."
"You're waiting too, eh?"
"So's he." Reed's head nodded backward in the direction of Carter's office.
"Waiting for the same thing?"
"For Benish to get here, of course. And yet, you know, I don't entirely believe it."
"Don't believe what?"
"I'm not sure the man has what he says he has. I'm a physiologist, to be sure, and not a physicist," Michael shrugged in self-deprecatory humor. "But I like to believe the experts. They say there's no way. I hear them say that the uncertainty principle makes it impossible to do it for longer than a given time. And you can't argue with the uncertainty principle, can you?"
"I'm no expert either, Max. But those same experts tell us that Benish is the biggest expert of them all in this field. The other side has had him, and they've kept even with us just because of him. Just because of him. They have no one else in the first rank, while we have Zaletsky, Kramer, Richtheim, Lindsay, and all the rest. And our biggest men believe he must have something, if he says he does."
"Do they? Or do they just think we can't afford not to take a chance on it? After all, even if he turns out to have nothing, we win just out of his defection. The others would no longer have the use of his service."
"Why should he lie?"
Michael said, "Why not? It's getting him out. It's getting him here, where I suppose he wants to be. If it turns out he has nothing, we're not going to send him back, are we? Besides, he may not be lying. He may just be mistaken."
"Humph."
Reed tilted his chair back and put his feet on the desk in most un-colonel-like manner.
"You've got a point there. And if he diddles us, it would serve Carter right. Serve them all right, damned fools.
You got nothing out of Carter, huh?"
"Nothing. He won't do a thing till Benish comes. He's counting the minutes, and now so am I. It's 42 minutes.
"Till when?"
"Till the plane carrying him lands at the airport. And the biosciences have nothing. If Benish is just pulling off a deal to escape from the other side, we have nothing. And if it's legitimate, we'll still have nothing. Defense will take it all, every slice, every crumb, every smell. It will be too pretty to play with, and they'll never let it go."
"Nonsense. Maybe just at first they will hang on, but we have our pressures, too.
We can turn Duval loose on them, the intense, God-fearing Peter."
A look of distaste came across Reed's face.
"I would love to throw him at the military. The way I feel now, I would love to throw him at Carter, too. If Duval were negatively charged and Carter positively charged, and I could get them together and let them spark each other to death..." "Don't get destructive, Don.
You take Duval too seriously. A surgeon is an artist, a sculptor of living tissue. A great surgeon is a great artist, and has the temperament of one. Well, I have temperament, too, and I don't use it to be one large pain in the buttocks. What gives Duval a monopoly on the right to be an offensive, arrogant son of a bitch? If he had the monopoly, my colonel, I would be delighted. I would leave it to him with all possible gratitude, if he had it all. The trouble is, there are so many other offensive, arrogant sons of bitches in the world. I suppose so, I suppose so, muttered Reed, but he was unmollified. 37 minutes. If anyone had repeated Reed's capsule description of Duval to Dr. Peter Lawrence Duval, it would have been met with the same short grunt that would have met a confession of love. It was not that Duval was insensible to either insult or adoration. It was merely that he reacted to them when he had time, and he rarely had time. It was not a scowl that he habitually wore on his face. It was rather the muscular contraction that came with thoughts that were elsewhere. Presumably, all men have their escape from the world. Duval's was the simple one of concentration upon his work. That route had brought him by his mid-40s to international renown as a brain surgeon, and to his scarce-realized status of bachelorhood. Nor did he look up from the careful measurements he was making on the tri-dimensionalized X-ray photographs that lay before him when the door opened. His assistant came in with the accustomed noiseless steps. "What is it, Miss Peterson?" he asked, and squinted even more painfully at the photographs. The depth perception was plain enough to the eye, but measuring the actual depth called for a delicate consideration of angles, plus an advanced knowledge of what that depth was likely to be in the first place. Cora Peterson waited for the moment of additional concentration to pass. She was 25, just 20 years younger than Duval, and her master's degree, only a year old, had been carefully laid at the feet of the surgeon. In the letters she wrote home, she explained almost every time that each day with Duval was a college course, that to study his methods, his techniques of diagnosis, his handling of the tools of his trade, was to be edified beyond belief. As for his dedication to his work and to the cause of healing, that could only be described as inspiring. In less intellectualized fashion, she was perfectly aware, with almost the awareness of a professional physiologist, of the quickening of her heartbeat as she took in the planes and curves of his face bent over his work and noted the quick, sure, unwavering motion of his fingers. Her face remained impassive, however, for she disapproved of the action of her unintellectual heart muscle. Her mirror told her clearly enough that she was not plain. Quite otherwise. Her dark eyes were ingenuously wide set. Her lips reflected quick humor when she let them do so, which wasn't often, and her figure annoyed her for its apparent propensity for interfering with a proper understanding of her professional competence. It was for her ability she wanted wolf whistles, or the intellectual equivalent, and not for the sinuosity she couldn't help. Duval, at least, appreciated her efficiency and seemed unmoved by her attractiveness, and for that, she admired him the more. She said, finally, "Benesh will be landing in less than 30 minutes, Doctor." He looked up. "Why are you here? Your day's over." Cora might have retorted that his was too, but she knew well that his day was over only when his work was done. She had stayed with him through the 16th consecutive hour often enough, although she imagined he would maintain, in all honesty, that he kept her firmly to an 8-hour day. She said, "I'm waiting to see him."
"Whom?"
"Benesh. Doesn't it excite you, Doctor?"
"No. Why should it?"
"He's a great scientist, and they say he has important information that will revolutionize all we're doing."
"It will, will it?"
Duval lifted the photograph on top of the heap, placed it to one side, and turned to the next.
"How will it help you with your laser work?"
"It can make the target easier to hit."
"It already does that. For what Benesh will add, only the war makers will have any use. All Benesh will do will be to increase the probability of world destruction."
"But, Dr. Duval, you've said that the extension of the technique could be of great importance to the neurophysiologist."
"Have I? All right, then, I have. But just the same, I'd rather you got your proper rest, Miss Peterson.
He looked up again, his voice softening just a bit, perhaps.
You look tired.
Cora's hand lifted halfway to her hair, for translated into the feminine, the word tired means disheveled. She said,
Once Benish arrives, I will, I promise. By the way...
Yes?
Will you be using the laser tomorrow?
It's what I'm trying to decide right now. If you'll let me, Miss Peterson.
The 6951 model can't be used.
Duval put the photograph down, leaned back.
Why not?
It's not reliable enough. I can't get it to focus properly. I suspect one of the tunnel diodes is faulty, but I haven't located which one yet.
All right. You set up one that can be trusted, just in case we need it, and do it before you leave. Then tomorrow
I'll track down what's wrong with the 6951.
Yes.
She turned to leave, looked quickly at her watch, and said,
21 minutes, and they say the plane's on time.
He made a vague sound, and she knew he hadn't heard. She left, closing the door behind her slowly and silently. Captain William Owens sank back into the softly cushioned seat of the limousine. He rubbed his sharp nose tiredly and set his wide jaws. He felt the car lift on its firm jets of compressed air, then move forward with absolute levelness. He caught no whisper of the turbo engine, though 500 horses champed behind him. Through the bulletproof windows to right and left, he could see a motorcycle escort. Other cars were before and behind, glimmering the night into a liveness of shielded light. It made him seem important, this half an army of guardians. But it wasn't for him, of course. It wasn't even for the man they were going out to meet. Not for the man as a man. Only for the contents of a great mind. The head of the Secret Service was to Owens' left. It was a sign of the anonymity of the service that Owens was not sure of the name of this nondescript man who, from rimless glasses to conservative shoes, seemed a college professor. Or a haberdasher's clerk.
Colonel Gander, Owens had said, tentatively, on shaking hands.
Gander, was the quiet response.
Good evening, Captain Owens.
They were on the outskirts of the airfield now. Somewhere above and ahead, surely not more than a few miles distant, was the archaic plane preparing for a landing.
A great day, eh? Said Gander softly. Everything about the man seemed to whisper, even the unobtrusive cut of his civilian clothing.
Yes, said Owens, striving to keep the tension out of that monosyllable.
It was not that he felt particularly tense. It was merely that his voice always seemed to carry that tone. It was that air of tension that seemed to fit his narrow, pinched nose, his slitted eyes, and the high jut of his cheekbones.
He sometimes felt it got in his way. People expected him to be neurotic when he wasn't. Not more so than others were, anyway.
On the other hand, people sometimes got out of his way for just that reason, without his having to lift a hand. Matters evened out, perhaps.
Owen said, Quite a coup getting him here. The service is to be congratulated.
The credit belongs to our agent. He's our best man. His secret, I think, is that he looks like the romantic stereotype of an agent.
Looks like one?
Tall. Played football at college. Good-looking. Terribly clean-cut. One look at him and any enemy would say, There. That's what one of their secret agents ought to look like, so of course he can't be one. And they dismiss him and find out too late that he is one.
Owens frowned. Was the man serious? Or was he joking because he thought that would relieve the tension?
Gander said, You realize, of course, that your part in this isn't something to be dismissed offhand. You will know him, won't you?
I'll know him, said Owens with his short, nervous laugh. I've met him several times at scientific conferences on the other side. I got drunk with him one night. Well, not really drunk. Joyous.
Did he talk?
I didn't get him drunk to make him talk. But anyway, he didn't talk. There was someone else with him. Their scientists go two by two at all times.
Did you talk?
The question was light. The intent behind it was clearly not. Owens laughed again. Believe me, Colonel, there is nothing I know that he doesn't. I could talk to him all day without harm.
I wish I knew something about this. You have my admiration, Captain. Here is a technological miracle capable of transforming the world, and there are only a handful of men who can understand it. Man's mind is getting away from man.
It's not that bad, really, said Owens. There are quite a lot of us. There's only one Benish, of course, and I'm miles from being in his class. In fact, I don't know much more than enough to apply the technique to my ship designs. That's all.
But you'll recognize Benish.
The Secret Service head seemed to require infinite reassurance. Even if he had a twin brother, which I'm sure he doesn't, I'd recognize him.
It's not exactly an academic point, Captain. Our agent Grant is good, as I've said, but even so, I am a little surprised that he managed it. I have to ask myself, is there a double-cross involved? Did they expect us to try to get Benish, and have they prepared a pseudo-Benish?
I can tell the difference, said Owens confidently.
You don't know what can be done these days with plastic surgery and narco-hypnosis.
It doesn't matter. The face can fool me, but the conversation won't. Either he knows the technique, Owens' momentary whisper clearly capitalized the word, better than I do, or he's not Benish, whatever he looks like. They can fake Benish's body, perhaps, but not his mind. They were on the field now. Colonel Gonder looked at his watch.
I hear it. The ship will be landing in minutes. And on time.
Armed men in armored vehicles splayed out to join those that had already surrounded the airfield and turned it into occupied territory sealed off against all but authorized personnel. The last of the city's lights had faded out, doing no more than to fuzz the horizon to the left. Owen's sigh was one of infinite relief. Benish would be here, at last, in one more moment. Happy ending? He frowned at the intonation in his mind that had put a question mark after those two words. Happy ending, he thought grimly, but the intonation slithered out of control so that it became happy ending again. Chapter 2. Car. Grant watched with intense relief the lights of the city drawing nearer as the plane began its long approach. No one had given him any real details as to the importance of Dr. Benish, except for the obvious fact that he was a defecting scientist with vital information. He was the most important man in the world, they had said, and then had neglected to explain why. Don't press, they had told him. Don't throw the grease in the fan by getting tense. But the whole thing is vital, they said. Unbelievably vital. Take it easy, they had said. But everything depends on it. Your country, your world, humanity. So it was done. He might never have made it if they hadn't been afraid of killing Benish. By the time they got to the point where they realized that killing Benish was the only way they could salvage even a draw, it was too late, and he was out. A bullet crease over the ribs was all Grant had to show for it, and a long band-aid took care of that. He was tired now, however, tired to the bone. Physically tired, of course, but also tired of the whole damned foolishness. In his college days, 10 years before, they had called him Granite Grant, and he had tried to live up to that on the football field, like a dumb jerk. One broken arm was the result, but at least he was lucky enough to have kept his teeth and nose intact, so that he could retain that craggy set of good looks. His lips twitched into a silent, flicking smile. And since then, too, he had discouraged the use of first names. Only the monosyllabic grunt of Grant. Very masculine. Very strong. Except to hell with it. What was it getting him except weariness and every prospect of a short life? He had just passed 30 now, and it was time to retire to his first name, Charles Grant. Maybe even Charlie Grant. Good old Charlie Grant. He winced, but then frowned himself firm again. It had to be. Good old Charlie. That was it. Good old soft Charlie, who likes to sit in a rocking chair and rock. Hi, Charlie, nice day. Hey there, Charlie, looks like rain. Get yourself a soft job, good old Charlie, and snooze your way to your pension. Grant looked sideways at Jan Benesch. Even he found something familiar about that shock of grizzled hair, the face with its strong, fleshy nose, the untidy, coarse mustache, likewise grizzled. Cartoonists made do with that nose and mustache alone, but there were his eyes, too, nestled in fine wrinkles, and there were the horizontal lines that never left his forehead. Benesch's clothes were moderately ill-fitting, but they had left hurriedly, without time for the better tailors. The scientist was pushing 50, Grant knew, but he looked older. Benesch was leaning forward, watching the lights of the approaching city. Grant said, "Ever been to this part of the country before, Professor?" "I have never been to any part of your country," said Benesch. Or was that intended to be a trick question? There was a faint but definite trace of accent in his speech.
"No, just making conversation. That's our second largest city up ahead. You can have it, though. I am from the other end of the country."
"To me, it doesn't matter. One end, the other end. As long as I'm here. It will be..."
He didn't finish the sentence, but there was a sadness in his eyes. Breaking away is hard, thought Grant, even when you feel you must. He said, "We'll see to it. You have no time to brood, Professor. We'll put you to work." Benesch retained his sadness.
"I'm sure of that. I expect it. It is the price I pay, no?"
"I'm afraid so. You cost us a certain amount of effort, you know."
Benesch put his hand on Grant's sleeve.
"You risked your life. I appreciate that. You might have been killed."
"I run the chance of being killed as a matter of routine. Occupational hazard. They pay me for it. Not as well as for playing a guitar, you understand, or for hitting a baseball, but about what they feel my life is worth."
"You can't dismiss it, sir."
"I've got to. My organization does. When I come back, there will be a shake of hands and an embarrassed good work. You know, manly reserve and all that. Then it's now for the next assignment, and we have to deduct for that band-aid you have on your side. Have to watch expenses."
"Your game of cynicism doesn't fool me, young man."
"It has to fool me, Professor, or I would quit." Grant was almost surprised at the sudden bitterness in his voice. "Strap yourself in, Professor. This flying junk heap makes rough landings."
The plane touched down smoothly despite Grant's prediction and taxied to a stop, turning as it did so. The Secret Service contingent closed in. Soldiers leaped out of troop-carrying trucks to form a cordon about the plane, leaving a corridor for the motorized stairway steering its way toward the door of the plane. A convoy of three limousines rolled to near the foot of the stairway. Owen said,
"You're piling on the security, Colonel."
"Better too much than too little."
His lips moved almost silently in what the astonished Owens recognized to be a quick prayer.
Owen said, "I'm glad he's here."
"Not as glad as I am. Planes have blown up in mid-flight before this, you know. We'll get him on terra firma."
The door to the plane opened, and Grant momentarily appeared at the opening. He looked about, then waved. Colonel Gonder said,
"He seems in one piece, anyway. Where's Benesch?"
As though in answer to that question, Grant flattened to one side and let Benesch squeeze past. Benesch stood there, smiling for one moment. Carrying one battered suitcase in his hand, he trotted gingerly down the steps. Grant followed. Behind him were the pilot and co-pilot. Colonel Gonder was at the foot of the stairs.
"Professor Benesch, glad to have you here. I'm Gonder. I'll be in charge of your safety from this point. This is William Owens. You know him, I think."
Benesch's eyes lit up and his arms went high as he dropped his suitcase. Colonel Gonder unobtrusively picked it up.
"Owens, yes, of course. We got drunk one night together. I remember it well. A long, dull, boring session in the afternoon, where all that was interesting was precisely what one could not say, so that despair settled on me like a gray blanket. At supper, Owens and I met. There were five of his colleagues with him, but I don't remember the others very well. But Owens and I, we went to a little club afterward, with dancing and jazz, and we drank schnapps, and Owens was very friendly with one of the girls. You remember Yaroslavic, Owens?"
"The fellow who was with you?" ventured Owens.
"Exactly. He loved schnapps with a love that passeth understanding, but he was not allowed to drink. He had to stay sober. Strict orders.
To watch you?
Benish signified assent by a single, long, vertical movement of his head and a sober out-thrusting of his lower lip.
I kept offering him liquor. I said, here, Milan, a dusty throat is bad for man, and he had to keep refusing, but with his heart in his eyes. It was wicked of me.
Owen smiled and nodded. But let's get into the limousine and get down to headquarters. We'll have to show you around first and let everyone see you're here. After that, I promise you that you'll sleep for 24 hours if you want to, before we ask you any questions.
16 will do.
But first, he looked about anxiously, where is Grant?
Ach, there is Grant.
He pushed toward the young agent.
Grant?
He held out his hand.
Goodbye. Thank you. Thank you very much. I will see you again, not so.
Could be, said Grant. I'm an easy man to see. Just look for the nearest rotten job, and I'll be right there on top of it.
I'm glad you took this rotten one.
Grant reddened. This rotten one had an important point to it, Professor. Glad to be of help. I mean that.
I know. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Benish waved, stepped back toward the limousine.
Grant turned to the colonel. Will I be breaking security if I knock off now, Chief?
Go ahead. And by the way, Grant.
Yes, sir.
Good work.
The expression, sir, is jolly good show. I don't answer to anything else. He touched a sardonic forefinger to his temple and walked off. Exit Grant, he thought. Then enter good old Charlie?
The colonel turned to Owens.
Get in with Benish and talk to him. I'll be in the car ahead. And then when we get to headquarters, I want you to be ready with a firm identification, if you have one, or a firm denial, if you have one. I don't want anything else.
He remembered that drinking episode, said Owens.
Exactly, said the colonel, discontentedly. He remembered it a little too quickly and a little too well. Talk to him?
They were all in, and the cavalcade moved off, picking up speed. From a distance, Grant watched, waved blindly at no one in particular, then moved off again. He had free time coming, and he knew exactly how he planned spending it after one night's sleep. He smiled in cheerful anticipation. The cavalcade picked its route carefully. The pattern of bustle and calm in the city varied from section to section and from hour to hour, and that which pertained to this section and this hour was known. The cars rumbled down empty streets through run-down neighborhoods of darkened warehouses. The motorcycles jounced on in front, and the colonel in the first limousine tried once again to estimate how the others would react to the successful coup. Sabotage at headquarters was always a possibility. He couldn't imagine what precautions remained to be taken, but it was an axiom in his business that no precautions were ever sufficient. A light? For just a moment, it had seemed to him that a light had flashed and dimmed in one of the hulks they were approaching. His hand flew to the telephone to alert the motorcycle escort. He spoke quickly and fiercely. From behind, a motorcycle raced forward. Even as it did so, an automobile engine, ahead and to one side, roared into life, muffled and nearly drowned by the multiple clatter of the oncoming cavalcade, and the automobile itself came hurtling out of an alley. Its headlights were off, and in the shock of its sudden approach, nothing registered with anyone. No one afterward could recall a clear picture of events. The car projectile aimed squarely at the limousine containing Benish met the motorcycle coming forward. In the crash that ensued, the motorcycle was demolished, its rider hurled many feet to one side and left broken and dead. The car projectile itself was deflected so that it merely struck the rear of the limousine. There were multiple collisions. The limousine, spinning out of control, smashed into a telephone pole and jolted to a stop. The kamikaze car, also out of control, hit a brick wall and burst into flame. The colonel's limousine ground to a halt. The motorcycle screeched, veering and turning. Gonder was out of his limousine, racing for the wrecked car, wrenching at the door. Owens, shaken, a reddened scrape on one cheekbone, said,
"What happened?"
"For God's sake, never mind that. How is Benish?"
"He's hurt."
"Is he alive?"
"Yes. Help me."
Together, they half-lifted, half-pulled Benish from the car.
Benish's eyes were open but glazed, and he made only incoherent little sounds.
"How are you, Professor?"
Owen said in a quick, low voice. His head cracked hard against the door handle. Concussion, probably. But he is Benish. That's certain. Gonder shouted,
"We know that now, you..."
He swallowed the last word with difficulty. The door to the first limousine was opened. Together, they lifted Benish in as a rifle shot cracked from somewhere above. Gonder threw himself into the car on top of Benish.
"Let's get the show out of here," he yelled.
The car and half the motorcycle escort moved on. The remainder stayed behind. Policemen ran for the building from which the rifle shot had sounded. The dying light of the burning kamikaze car cast a hellish glow on the scene. There was the rustle in the distance of the beginnings of a gathering crowd. Gonder cradled Benish's head on his lap. The scientist was completely unconscious now, his breathing slow, his pulse feeble. Gonder stared earnestly at the man who might well be dead at any moment, and muttered despairingly to himself,
"We were almost there. Almost there."
Chapter 3. Headquarters. Grant was only dopily aware of the hammering at his door. He stumbled upright and emerged from his bedroom, walking flat-footedly across the cold floor and yawning prodigiously.
"Coming."
He felt drugged, and he wanted to feel drugged. In the way of business, he was trained to come alive at any extraneous noise, instant alertness. Take a mass of sleep, add a pinch of thump, and there would be an instant and vast flowering of qui vive. But now he happened to be on his own time, and to hell with it.
"What do you want?"
"From the colonel, sir," came from the other side of the door. "Open at once." Against his will, Grant jolted into wakefulness. He stepped to one side of the door and flattened against the wall. He then opened the door as far as the chain would allow and said,
"Shove your ID card here."
A card was thrust at him, and he took it into his bedroom. He groped for his wallet and pinched out his identifier. He inserted the card and read the result on the translucent screen. He brought it back and unhinged the chain, ready, despite himself, for the appearance of a gun or for some sign of hostility. But the young man who entered looked completely harmless.
"You'll have to come with me, sir, to headquarters." "What time is it?"
"About 6:45, sir."
"A.M.?"
"Yes, sir."
"Damn it, why do they need me this time of day?"
"I can't say, sir. I'm following orders. I must ask you to come with me."
"Sorry."
He tried a wry joke.
"I didn't want to get up myself, but here I am."
"Do I have time to shave and shower?"
"Well, all right then. Do I have time to dress?"
"Yes, sir. But quickly." Grant scraped at the stubble along the angle of his jaw with his thumb and was glad he had showered the night before.
"Give me 5 minutes for clothes and necessities."
He called out from the bathroom,
"What's it all about?"
"I don't know, sir."
"What headquarters are we going to?"
"I don't think..."
"Never mind."
The sound of rushing water made further speech impossible for a moment. Grant emerged, feeling somberly semi-civilized.
"But we're going to headquarters. You said that, right?"
"Yes, sir."
"All right, son," said Grant pleasantly. "But if I think you're about to cross me, I'll cut you in two."
"Yes, sir."
Grant frowned when the car stopped. The dawn was gray and dank. There was a hint of forthcoming rain. The area was a run-down melange of warehouses, and a quarter mile back they had passed a roped-off area.
"What happened here?"
Grant had asked, and his companion was the usual mine of non-information. Now they stopped, and Grant gently placed his hand on the butt of his holstered revolver.
"You'd better tell me what happens next."
"We're here. This is a secret government installation. It doesn't look it, but it is."
The young man got out, and so did the driver.
"Please stay in the car, Mr. Grant."
The two stepped away for 100 feet, while Grant looked warily about. There was a sudden jerk of movement, and for a split second he was thrown off balance. Recovering, he began to fling the car door open, then hesitated in astonishment as smooth walls grew upward all about him. It took him a moment to realize that he was sinking along with the car, that the car had been sitting on the top of an elevator shaft. By the time he had drunk that in, it was too late to try to get out. Overhead, a lid moved into place, and for a while Grant was in complete darkness. He flicked on the car's headlights, but they splashed uselessly back from the round curve of the rising wall. There was nothing to do but wait for an interminable 3 minutes, and then the car stopped. Two large doors opened, and Grant's tensed muscles were ready for action. He called them off at once. A two-man scooter bearing one MP, one obvious MP in a completely legitimate military uniform, was waiting for him. On his helmet were the letters CMDF. On the scooter were the same letters. Automatically, Grant put words to the initials. Centralized Mountain Defense Forces, he muttered. Coastal Marine Department Fisheries. What? He said aloud. He had not heard the MP's remark. If you'll get in, sir, repeated the MP with stiff propriety, indicating the empty seat. Sure. Quite a place you have here. Yes, sir. How big is it? They were passing through a cavernous, empty area, with trucks and motor carts lined against the wall, each with its CMDF insignia. Pretty big, said the MP. That's what I like about everybody here, said Grant. Full of priceless nuggets of data. The scooter moved smoothly up a ramp to a higher level, a well-populated one. Uniformed individuals, both male and female, moved about busily, and there was an indefinable but undeniable air of agitation about the place. Grant caught himself watching a girl in what looked like a nurse's uniform, CMDF, neatly printed over the curve of one breast, and he remembered the plans he had begun to make the evening before. If this was another assignment... The scooter made a sharp turn and stopped before a desk. The MP scrambled out. Charles Grant, sir. The officer behind the desk was unmoved at the information. Name, he said. Charles Grant, said Grant, like the nice man said. ID card, please. Grant handed it over. It carried an embossed number only, to which the officer gave one curt glance. He inserted it into the identifier on his desk while Grant watched without much interest. It was precisely like his own wallet identifier, overgrown and acromegalous. The gray, featureless screen lit up with his own portrait, full face and profile, looking, as it always did in Grant's own eyes, darkly and menacingly gangsterish. Where was the open, frank look? Where the charming smile? Where the dimples in his cheeks that drove the girls mad? Mad? Only those dark, lowering eyebrows remained to give him that angry look. It was a wonder anyone recognized him. The officer did, and apparently without trouble. One glance at the photo, one at Grant. The ID card was whipped out, handed back, and he was waved on. The scooter turned right, passed through an archway, and then down a long corridor, marked off for traffic, two lanes each way. Traffic was heavy, too, and Grant was the only one not uniformed. Doors repeated themselves at almost hypnotically periodic intervals on either side, with pedestrian lanes immediately adjacent to the walls. Those were less heavily populated. The scooter approached another archway, over which was a sign reading, Medical Division. An MP on duty in a raised box like that of a traffic policeman hit a switch. Heavy steel doors opened and the scooter slid through and came to a stop. Grant wondered what part of the city he was under by now. The man in the general's uniform who was approaching hastily looked familiar. Grant placed him just before they had closed to within handshaking distance. Carter, isn't it? We met on the Transcontinental a couple of years ago. You weren't in uniform then. Hello, Grant. Oh, damn the uniform. I wear it only for status in this place. It's the only way we can establish a chain of command. Come with me. Granite, Grant, wasn't it? Oh, well.
They passed through a door into what was obviously an operating room. Grant glanced out through the observation window to see the usual sight of men and women in white, bustling about in almost visible asepsis, surrounded by the hard gleam of metalware, sharp and cold, and all of it dwarfed and rendered insignificant by the proliferation of electronic instruments that had converted medicine into a branch of engineering. An operating table was being wheeled in, and a full shock of grizzled hair streamed out over the white pillow. It was then that Grant had his worst stab of surprise.
Benish?
He whispered.
Benish,
said General Carter obliquely.
What happened to him? They got to him after all. Our fault. We live in an electronic age, Grant.
Everything we do with our transistorized servants in hand. Every enemy we have, we ward off by manipulating an electron flow. We had the route bugged in every possible way, but only for electronified enemies. We didn't count on an automobile with a man at the controls, and on rifles with men at the triggers. I suppose you got none of them alive?
None.
The man in the car died on the spot. The others were killed by our bullets. We lost a few ourselves.
Grant looked down again. There was the look of emptiness on Benish's face that one associated with deep sedation.
I assume he's alive so that there's hope.
He's alive, but there isn't much hope.
Grant said, did anyone have a chance to talk to him?
Captain Owens, William Owens, do you know him?
Grant shook his head.
Just a glance at the airport at someone Gonda referred to by that name.
Carter said, Owens spoke to Benish, but got no crucial information. Gonda spoke to him. You spoke to him more than anyone. Did he tell you anything?
No, sir. I would not have understood if he had. It was my mission to get him into this country and nothing more.
Of course. But you talked to him, and he might have said more than he meant to.
If he did, it went right over my head.
But I don't think he did. Living on the other side, you get practice keeping your mouth shut.
Carter scowled.
Don't be unnecessarily superior, Grant. You get the same practice on this side. If you don't know that...
I'm sorry. That was unnecessary.
It's all right, General.
Grant shrugged it off tonelessly.
Well, the point is, he talked to no one. He was put out of action before we could get what we wanted out of him. He might as well never have left the other side.
Grant said, coming here, I passed a place cordoned off.
That was the place. 5 more blocks and we would have had him safe.
What's wrong with him now?
Brain injury. We have to operate. And that's why we need you.
Me? Grant said, strenuously.
Listen, General, that brain surgery, I'm a child. I flunked advanced cerebellum at Old State U.
Carter did not react, and to Grant his own words sounded hollow.
Come with me, said Carter.
Grant followed through a door, down a short stretch of corridor, and into another room.
Central monitoring, said Carter briefly.
The walls were covered with TV panels. The central chair was half surrounded by a semicircular console of switches banked on a steep incline. Carter sat down while Grant remained standing.
Carter said, let me give you the essence of the situation. You understand there's a stalemate between ourselves and them.
And has been for a long time, of course.
The stalemate isn't a bad thing altogether. We compete, we run scared all the time, and we get a lot done that way. Both of us. But if the stalemate must break, it's got to break in favor of our side. You see that, I suppose.
I think I do, General, said Grant dryly.
Benish represents the possibility of such a break. If he could tell us what he knows...
May I ask a question, sir?
Go ahead.
What does he know?
What sort of thing?
Not yet. Just wait a few moments.
The exact nature of the information is not crucial at the moment.
Let me continue.
If he could tell us what he knows, then the stalemate breaks on our side. If he died, or even if he recovers but without being able to give us our information because of brain damage, then the stalemate continues.
Grant said, aside from humanitarian sorrow for the loss of a great mind, we can say that maintaining the stalemate isn't too bad.
Yes, if the situation is just as I have described, but it may not be.
How do you make that out?
Consider Benish. He is known as a moderate, but we had no indication that he was having trouble with his government. He had shown every sign of being loyal for a quarter of a century, and he'd been well treated. Now he suddenly defects.
Because he wants to break the stalemate on our side.
Does he? Or could it be that he revealed enough of his work before realizing its full significance to give the other side the key to the advance? He may then have come to realize that, without quite meaning to, he had placed world dominion securely into the hands of his own side. And perhaps he wasn't sufficiently confident in the virtues of his own side to be satisfied with that.
So now he comes to us, not so much to give us the victory as to give no one the victory. He comes to us in order to maintain the stalemate.
Is there any evidence for that, sir?
Not one bit, said Carter. But you see it as a possibility, I presume, and you realize that there is not one bit of evidence against it, either.
Go on.
If the matter of life or death for Benish meant a choice between total victory for us or continued stalemate, well, we could manage. To lose our chance of total victory would be a damned shame, but we might get another chance tomorrow. However, what might be facing us is a choice between stalemate and total defeat. And there, one of the alternatives is completely unbearable. Do you agree?
Of course.
You see, then, that if there is even a small possibility that Benish's death will involve us in total defeat, then that death must be prevented at any price, at any cost, at any risk.
I take it you mean that statement for my benefit, General, because you're going to ask me to do something. As it happens, I've risked my life to prevent eventualities considerably short of total defeat. I have never really enjoyed it, if you want a confession, but I've done it. However, what can I do in the operating room? When I needed a band-aid over my short ribs yesterday, Benish had to put it on for me. And compared to other aspects of medical technique, I'm very good at band-aids.
Carter didn't react to that either. Gander recommended you for this. On general principles, in the first place, he considers you a remarkably capable man. So do I.
General, I don't need the flattery. I find it irritating.
Damn it, man, I'm not flattering you. I'm explaining something. Gander considers you capable in general, but more than that, he considers your mission incomplete. You were to get Benish to us safely, and that has not been done.
He was safe when I was relieved by Gander himself.
Nevertheless, he is not safe now.
Are you appealing to my professional pride, General?
If you like.
All right. I'll hold the scalpels. I'll wipe the perspiration from the surgeon's forehead. I'll even wink at the nurses. I think that's the complete list of my competencies in an operating room.
You won't be alone. You'll be part of a team.
I somehow expect that, said Grant. Someone else will have to aim the scalpels and push them. I just hold them in a tray. Carter manipulated a few switches with a sure touch. On one TV screen, a pair of figures in dark glasses came into instant view. They were bent intently over a laser beam, its red light narrowing to thread-like thinness. The light flashed out, and they removed their glasses.
Carter said, "That's Peter Duval. Have you ever heard of him?"
"Sorry, but no."
"He's the top brain surgeon in the country."
"Who's the girl?"
"She assists him."
"Don't be single-tracked. She's an extremely competent technician."
Grant wilted a bit.
"I'm sure of it, sir."
"You say you saw Owens at the airport?"
"Very briefly, sir."
"He'll be with you, too. Also, our chief of the medical section. He'll brief you."
Another quick manipulation, and this time the TV screen came on with that low buzz that signified two-way sound attachment. An amiable bald head at close quarters dwarfed the intricate network of a circulatory system that filled the wall behind.
Carter said, "Max?"
Michaels looked up, his eyes narrowed. He looked rather washed out.
"Yes, Al." "Grant is ready for you. Hurry it on. There isn't much time." "There certainly isn't. I'll come get him."
For a moment, Michaels caught Grant's eye. He said slowly, "I hope you're prepared, Mr. Grant, for the most unusual experience of your life. Or of anyone's."
Chapter 4. Briefing.
In Michael's office, Grant found himself looking open-mouthed at the map of the circulatory system. Michael said,
"It's an unholy mess, but it's a map of the territory. Every mark on it is a road. Every junction is a crossroad. That map is as intricate as a road map of the United States. More so, for it's in three dimensions."
"Good Lord."
100,000 miles of blood vessels. You see very little of it now. Most of it is microscopic and won't be visible to you without considerable magnification.
but put it all together in a single line, and it would go 4 times around the Earth, or, if you prefer, nearly halfway to the moon.
Have you had any sleep, Grant?
About 6 hours. I napped on the plane, too. I'm in good shape.
Good. You'll have a chance to eat and shave and tend to other such matters if necessary.
I wish I had slept.
He held up a hand as soon as he had said that. Not that I'm in bad shape. I'm not complaining. Have you ever taken a morphogen?
Never heard of it. Is it some kind of drug?
Yes. Relatively new. It's not the sleep you need, you know. One doesn't rest in sleep to any greater extent than one would by stretching out comfortably with the eyes open. Less, maybe. It's the dreams we need. We've got to have dreaming time. Otherwise, cerebral coordination breaks down and you begin to have hallucinations and, eventually, death.
The morphogen makes you dream? Is that it?
Exactly. It knocks you out for half an hour of solid dreaming and then you're set for the day. Take my advice, though, and stay away from the stuff unless it's an emergency.
Why? Does it leave you tired?
No, not particularly tired. It's just that the dreams are bad. The morphogen vacuums the mind, cleans out the mental garbage accumulated during the day, and it's quite an experience.
Don't do it. I had no choice. That map had to be prepared, and I spent all night at it.
That map?
It's Benish's system to the last capillary, and I've had to learn all I could concerning it. Up here, almost centrally located in the cranium, right near the pituitary, is the blood clot.
Is that the problem?
It certainly is. Everything else can be handled. The general bruises and contusions, the shock, the concussion. The clot can't be. Not without surgery. And quickly.
How long has he got, Dr. Michaels?
Can't say. It won't be fatal, we hope, for quite a while, but brain damage will come long before death does. And for this organization, brain damage will be as bad as death. The people here expect miracles from our Benish, and now they've been badly rattled. Carter, in particular, has had a bad blow and wants you.
Grant said, "You mean he expects the other side will try again?"
"He doesn't say so, but I suspect that's what he fears and why he wants you on the team."
Grant looked about. "Is there any reason to think this place has been penetrated? Have they planted agents here?"
"Not to my knowledge, but Carter is a suspicious man. I think he suspects the possibility of medical assassination."
"Duval?"
Michael shrugged.
"He's an unpopular character, and the instrument he uses can cause death if it slips a hairbreadth."
"How can he be stopped?"
"He can't."
"Then use someone else, someone you can trust."
"No one else has the necessary skill. And Duval is right here with us. And after all, there is no proof that he isn't completely loyal."
"But if I am placed near Duval as a male nurse, and if I am assigned the task of watching him closely, I will do no good. I won't know what he's doing, or whether he's doing it honestly and correctly. In fact, I tell you that when he opens the skull, I'll probably pass out."
"He won't open the skull," said Michaels. "The clot can't be reached from outside. He's definite about that."
"But then, we'll reach it from the inside."
Grant frowned. Slowly, he shook his head.
"You know, I don't know what the hell you're talking about."
Michael said quietly, "Mr. Grant, everyone else engaged in this project knows the score and understands exactly what he or she is to do. You're the outsider, and it is rather a chore to have to educate you. Still, if I must, I must. I'm going to have to acquaint you with some of the theoretical work done in this institution."
Grant's lip quirked.
"Sorry, doctor, but you've just said a naughty word. At college, I majored in football with a strong minor in girls. Don't waste theory on me."
"I have seen your record, Mr. Grant, and it is not quite as you say. However, I will not deprive you of your manhood by accusing you of your obvious intelligence and education, even if we are in private. I will not waste theory on you, but will get the nub of the information to you without that. I assume you have observed our insignia, CMDF?
"Sure have."
"Do you have any idea of what it means?"
I've made a few guesses. How about Consolidated Martian Dimwits and Fools? I've got a better one than that, but it's unprintable.
It happens to stand for Combined Miniature Deterrent Forces.
That makes less sense than my suggestion, said Grant.
I'll explain. Have you ever heard of the miniaturization controversy?
Grant thought a while. I was in college then. We spent a couple of sessions on it in the physics course.
In between football games?
Yes, in the off-season, as a matter of fact. If I remember it, a group of physicists claimed they could reduce the size of objects to any degree, and it was exposed as a fraud. Well, maybe not a fraud, but a mistake anyway. I remember the class ran through several arguments showing why it was impossible to reduce a man to the size of, say, a mouse and keep him a man.
I'm sure this was done in every college in the land. Do you remember any of the objections?
I think so. If you're going to reduce size, you can do it in one of two ways. You can push the individual atoms of an object closer together, or you can discard a certain proportion of the atoms altogether. To push the atoms together against the interatomic repulsive forces would take extraordinary pressures. The pressures at the center of Jupiter would be insufficient to compress a man to the size of a mouse. Am I right so far?
You are luminous as the day.
And even if you managed it, the pressure would kill anything alive. Aside from that, an object reduced in size by pushing atoms together would retain all its original mass, and an object the size of a mouse with a mass of a man would be difficult to handle.
Amazing, Mr. Grant. You must have amused your girlfriends for many hours with this romantic talk.
And the other method?
The other method is to remove atoms in careful ratio so that the mass and size of an object decreases while the relationship of the parts remains constant. Only if you reduce a man to the size of a mouse, you can keep only one atom out of maybe 70,000. If you do that to the brain, what is left is scarcely more complicated than the brain of a mouse in the first place. Besides, how do you re-expand the object, as the miniaturizing physicists claimed to be able to do? How do you get the atoms back and put them in their right places?
Quite so, Mr. Grant.
But then, how did some reputable physicists come to think that miniaturization was practical?
I don't know, Doctor. But you don't hear of it anymore.
Partly because the colleges did such a careful job, under orders, of knocking it on the head. The technique went underground, both here and on the other side. Literally, here. Underground. It was almost with passion that Michaels tapped the desk before him. And we must maintain special courses in miniaturization techniques for graduate physicists who can learn it nowhere else, except in analogous schools on the other side. Miniaturization is quite possible, but by neither method you have described.
Have you ever seen a photograph enlarged, Mr. Grant, or reduced to microfilm size?
Of course.
Without theory, then, I tell you that the same process can be used on three-dimensional objects. Even on a man. We are miniaturized not as literal objects, but as images, as three-dimensional images manipulated from outside the universe of space-time.
Grant smiled. Now, teacher, those are just words.
Yes, but you don't want theory, do you? What physicists discovered 10 years ago was the utilization of hyperspace, a space, that is, of more than the three ordinary spatial dimensions. The concept is beyond grasping, the mathematics are almost beyond grasp, but the funny part is that it can be done. Objects can be miniaturized. We neither get rid of atoms nor push them together. We reduce the size of the atoms, too. We reduce everything, and the mass decreases automatically. When we wish, we restore the size.
You sound serious, said Grant. Are you telling me that we can really reduce a man to the size of a mouse?
In principle, we can reduce a man to the size of a bacterium, of a virus, of an atom. There is no theoretical limit to the amount of miniaturization.
We can shrink an army with all its men and equipment to a size that will fit in a matchbox. Ideally, we could then ship that matchbox where it is needed and put the army into business after restoring it to full size. You see the significance?
Grant said, and the other side can do it too, I take it.
We're certain they can. But come, Grant. Matters are progressing at full speed and our time is limited. Come with me.
It was come with me here and come with me there. Since Grant had awakened that morning, he had not been allowed to remain in one place for longer than 15 minutes. It annoyed him, and yet there seemed nothing he could do about it. Was it a deliberate attempt to keep him from having time enough to think? What were they preparing to spring on him? He and Michaels were in the scooter now, Michaels handling it like a veteran.
If both we and they have it, we neutralize each other, said Grant.
Yes, but in addition, said Michaels, it does neither of us very much good. There's a catch.
Oh?
We've worked for 10 years to extend the size ratio, to reach greater intensities of miniaturization, and of expansion, too. Just a matter of reversing the hyperfield. Unfortunately, we've reached our theoretical limits in this direction.
What are they?
Not very favorable. The uncertainty principle intervenes. Extent of miniaturization multiplied by the duration of miniaturization, using the proper units, of course, is equal to an expression containing Planck's constant. If a man is reduced to half size, he can be kept so for centuries. If he is reduced to mouse size, that can be kept up for days. If he is reduced to bacterium size, he can be kept up only for hours. After that, he expands again.
But then he can be miniaturized again.
Only after a sizable lag period. Do you want some of the mathematical background?
No. I'll take your word for everything.
They had arrived at the foot of an escalator. Michaels, with a small, weary grunt, got out of the scooter. Grant vaulted the side. He leaned against the railing as the staircase moved majestically upward.
And what has Benish got?
They tell me he claims he can beat the uncertainty principle. Supposedly, he knows how to maintain miniaturization indefinitely.
You don't sound as though you believe that.
Michaels shrugged. I am skeptical. If he extends both miniaturization intensity and miniaturization duration, that can only be at the expense of something else. But for the life of me, I can't imagine what that something else might be.
Perhaps that only means I am not a Benish.
In any case, he says he can do it, and we cannot take the chance of not believing him. Neither can the other side. So they've tried to kill him. They had come to the top of the escalator, and Michaels had paused there briefly to complete his remark. Now he moved back to take a second escalator up another floor. Now, Grant, you can understand what we must do. Save Benish. Why we must do it? For the information he has. And how we must do it? By miniaturization.
Why by miniaturization?
Because the brain clot cannot be reached from outside. I told you that. So we will miniaturize a submarine, inject it into an artery, and with Captain Owens at the controls and with myself as pilot, journey to the clot. There, Duval and his assistant, Miss Peterson, will operate.
Grant's eyes opened wide. And I?
You will be along as a member of the crew. General supervision, apparently.
Grant said violently,
Not I. I am not volunteering for any such thing. Not for a minute.
He turned and started walking down the up escalator with little effect. Michaels followed him, sounding amused.
It is your business to take risks, isn't it?
Risks of my own choosing. Risks I am used to. Risks I am prepared for. Give me as much time to think of miniaturization as you have had, and I'll take the risk.
My dear Grant, you have not been asked to volunteer. It is my understanding that you have been assigned to this duty. And now its importance has been explained to you. After all, I am going too, and I am not as young as you, nor have I ever been a football player. In fact, I'll tell you, I was depending on you to keep my courage up by coming along,
since courage is your business.
If so, I'm a rotten businessman, muttered Grant. Irrelevantly, almost petulantly, he said, I want coffee.
He stood still and let the escalator carry him up again. Near the top of the escalator was a door marked conference room. They entered. Grant grew aware of the contents of the room in stages. What he saw first was that one end of the long table that filled the center of the room was a multi-cup coffee dispenser, and that next to it was a tray of sandwiches. He moved toward that end of the table at once, and it was only after downing half a cup of coffee, hot and black, and following that by a Grant-sized bite at a sandwich, that item, too, entered his awareness. This was Duval's assistant. Miss Peterson, wasn't that her name? Looking down in the mouth, but very beautiful, and standing terribly close to Duval. Grant had the instant feeling that he was going to find it difficult to like the surgeon, and only then did he begin to absorb the rest of the room. A colonel sat at one end of the table, looking annoyed. One hand twirled an ashtray slowly while the ashes of a cigarette dropped to the floor. He said emphatically to Duval,
I've made my attitude quite clear.
Grant recognized Captain Owens standing under the portrait of the president. The eagerness and smiles he had seen at the airport were gone, and there was a bruise on one cheekbone. He looked nervous and upset, and Grant sympathized with the sensation.
Who's the colonel? Grant asked Michaels in a low voice.
Donald Reed, my opposite number on the military side of the fence.
I take it he's annoyed with Duval.
Constantly. He's got a lot of company. Few like him. Grant had the impulse to answer, she seems to, but the words sounded petty in his thoughts and he dismissed them. Lord, what a dish. What did she see in that solemn cutthroat?
Reed was talking in a low voice, carefully controlled. And aside from that, Doctor, what is she doing here?
Miss Cora Peterson, said Duval icily, is my assistant. Where I go professionally, she accompanies me professionally. This is a dangerous mission, and Miss Peterson has volunteered, understanding full well its dangers. A number of men, entirely qualified to help, have also volunteered. Matters would be far less complicated if one of those men accompanied you. I will assign you one.
You will not assign me one, Colonel, for if you do, I will not go. And there will be no power to make me. Miss Peterson is a third and fourth arm to me. She knows my requirements well enough to do her job without instructions, to be there before I call, to supply what is needed without being asked. I will not take a stranger who will need to be shouted at. I cannot be responsible for success if I lose one second because my technician and I do not mesh. And I will not take any assignment in which I am not given a free hand with which to arrange matters in such a way as will carry with it the best chance for success.
Grant's eye moved to Cora Peterson again. She looked acutely embarrassed, yet stared at Duval with the expression Grant had once seen in a beagle's eye when its little boy owner returned from school. Grant found that intensely annoying. Michael's voice cut across the argument as Reed was rising furiously to his feet.
I would suggest, Don, that since the key step of the entire operation rests upon Dr. Duval's hand and eye, and since, in fact, we cannot now dictate to him, we humor him in this respect, without prejudice to necessary action afterward, eh? I am willing to take responsibility for that.